Hello everyone, it's a pleasure to have been invited here to talk to you today about my research. So my broad research is actually on masculinities, contraception and sexual health in late 20th century Britain, so it's quite broad at the moment. But the paper I'm giving today is on the emotional politics of family planning campaigns in late 20th century Britain. But the paper today has got a specific focus on one particular campaign that the FPA did called Men 2 in the 1980s. So in 1984, the FPA announced that the Mayor Responsibility Campaign was concerned with encouraging more men to take responsibility for their personal and sexual relationships, including contraception, as partners, husbands, parents, and individuals. And these beer mats, seen here, were part of the MR project, which was to take unlikely and unexpected forms. They were displayed in 6,500 pubs across Britain to encourage male contraceptive responsibility. Oh, sorry. Lost where I am now. Ignore me a minute. In Britain between September 1984 and August 1985, as part of a much wider and equally innovative campaign to encourage male contraceptive responsibility developed by the FPA, which eventually became known as Men 2. Quote, the project was launched on the 2nd of October 1984 when the FPA announced its plans to communicate the idea, particularly but not only to young men through its work in information.
Could you just speak a little slower?
Yeah, sorry. Young men through its work in information and education during 1984-5, the organisation stated. So these beer mats then contain numerous insights into the demographic the FPA were targeting. The audience they imagined was both young and male, whom was also both implicitly working class and urban. This is indicated by the FPA's decision to display the beer mats in pubs, a traditionally working class masculine environment, alongside campaign posters on British Darts Association wall charts. Darts also being a working class pastime, as many of you all know. So the progressive message, family planning is for everybody, as you can see on the board here, printed on a medium traditionally reserved for commercial advertising and displayed in this particular setting of the pub, provides a glimpse of a wider transformation happening in 1980s Britain. So Men 2 emblematised a shift in FPA focus, but also the reconfiguration of masculinity, sexual politics, and within the nature of the political in general, including the forms through which politics was conducted. And also of significance here, how issues of public health were communicated to various publics. This paper explores understandings of gender and sexual politics in the 1980s through the lens of the FPA's Men 2 campaign, offering an alternative perspective on politics and also emotional politics in the 1980s. So it draws primarily on the educational film Danny's Big Night, and the Men 2 beer mats here on the board, to determine the audience the FPA were targeting, to illustrate an interest in the contraceptive involvement of young working class men. I also argue that Men 2 must be understood through the prism of new sexual subjects, i.e. the uninvolved male contraceptor, and in turn the FPA, the campaign refracted wide understandings of gender and sexuality in the 1980s. So when the FPA launched Men 2 for the year 1984-5, it was designed to promote discussion around male involvement in contraception and encourage men to take more responsibility for their personal relationships. The FPA were not alone in this expression of interest, however, and Men 2 represented a paradigm shift in family planning circles towards considering and fundamentally valuing male involvement in contraception in the 1980s. So the FPA campaigns were echoed by similar organisations, including those done by Brock Advisory Centres, which I know Hannah works on, and more globally by International Planned Parenthood Federation, when male responsibility was a watchword gaining increasing currency in wider family planning circles by the 1980s. So I also argue that this interest in male contraceptive involvement amongst family planning advocates and the wider public was part of a much broader homogenising process between traditionally separate and often gendered cultures of contraception in the late 20th century. Something I discuss in more detail in my thesis, but I don't really have time to go into much today, unfortunately. What is distinctive about the moment inhabited by Men 2 in 1984-5 is that it is tackling a generationally specific problem produced by the conjectural forces of technology, in this case the pill, and ideology, which was in part influenced by the rise of the women's liberation movement in the 1970s. This is further underlined by the fact that the campaign predates the moral panic over AIDS, which then transforms the debate about contraceptive responsibility all over again. So Men 2 is significant because it was the first visibly striking systematic public affirmation of the FPA's interest in male contraceptive involvement. This marked a shift in the charity's focus, loosening its former reputation as an all-female service. As well as trying to attract more men to family planning clinics, their £40,000 campaign encompassed numerous initiatives spread throughout the year 1984-5. Mentoo combined more conventional campaigning methods, including an initial press release, with more innovative initiatives such as these beer mats. Two educational videos, Danny's Big Night and Boys 2, were produced, as well as various leaflets and publications. The campaign culminated in its final major initiative, those were the FPA's words, a national conference on men, sex and relationships, the first by any organisation to explore such themes, which was held on the 29th of March 1985 at the Institute of Education here in London. So the conference claimed to explore all aspects of male sexuality, but maintained a specific focus on contraceptive practice and intimate heterosexual relationships. As well as playing host to the premiere of Danny's Big Night, the conference featured various talks, workshops exploring themes such as men, sex and personal relationships, and men and contraceptives, as well as the presentation of cartoons on the theme by Guardian cartoonist Posy Simmons. It was chaired by Paul Boateng of the Greater London Council, who was an interesting choice of the FPA, primarily due to his affiliation with the Labour Party. The FPA cite this apparent interest in family planning, stating further that he was concerned with civil liberties, which was code for the inner city, as well as having a modern family of his own. He had two daughters. During the conference plenary, Boateng also stressed that personal relationships between men and women are not just personal relationships, they're political relationships too. So the FPA then were instrumental in bringing the personal or the intimate everyday practices into the political realm, as demonstrated most notably via its long-term aim to enshrine universal access to free contraceptive services into legislation, which was eventually achieved with the passing of the 1973 NHS Act. I think I've got that wrong there, 1974 it should be. Beyond this, the FPA politicised bodily practices and emotional intimacies, governing them in more subtle but equally profound ways. This is demonstrated by the politicisation of everyday sexual practices, including the routine use of contraception and the conduct of men in their most intimate, everyday relationships in their roles as, quote, husbands, partners, fathers, and as individuals. Ultimately, the FPA's Mentoo campaign represents the new expanded nature of politics in general in 20th century Britain, wherein the intimate and the everyday and the personal and the twin concepts of the self and identity became increasingly politicised after the Second World War. So going beyond the study of the politics of expertise and existing work on NGOs, this paper offers a much closer examination of the ordinary and the everyday, and specifically on emotions, sexual and intimate behaviour. So while the campaign appeared straightforwardly progressive, I argue that Mentoo represented a new code of liberal responsibility through the creation of discourse that emphasised the freedom of the individual within the confines of new norms of behaviour, produced through understandings of their service users, or rather, in this case, non-service users. In addition, then, the campaign also represents a key phase in the history of the voluntary sector, as NGOs shifted emphasis from working to regulate the law towards providing advice and information, in this case, in an attempt to regulate contraceptive practice and personal relationships. However, NGOs are not just a useful way of understanding politics, but much more besides. This paper stresses the importance of studying them primarily for what they can reveal about the organisation's special interest, so in this case, contraception. Tracing the trajectories that made Mentoo possible provides a productive case study through which to explore the nature and scope of sexual politics in the 1980s to shift how we think about gender and contraception in contemporary Britain. So the campaign then was product of numerous different different trajectories converging and intersecting with immediate changes stimulated by events in the 1980s, culminating with in 1983 with the latest concerns over the oral contraceptive pill. Amongst family planners, these anxieties were then magnified by the knowledge that younger men and women had essentially grown up on the pill. This highly effective and popular contraceptive introduced in Britain in 1961 did not typically enable what the FPA termed joint decision making. The FPA promoted this, but as the pill removed any need for negotiation immediately prior to intercourse, this became a problem. Therefore, men, particularly younger men, were not expected to take a very active role in contraception and were also assumed to have had little experience of alternative methods. This was unfolding during a time of swelling interest in men's role, both within the family and in society more broadly, a process within which the campaign is also situated. So this case study reveals that the FPA understood masculine norms to be directly informing men's contraceptive practice. In other words, understandings of male involvement in contraception were informed by knowledge of masculinity at the FPA, an understanding shared by similar organisations, including Brooke. So not to Hannah there again. This idea that gendered discourses govern attitudes and behaviour is situated more broadly into the growing understanding of gender as a central organising principle of society during this time. It also gives us new ways of thinking about the transformation of masculinities in the 1980s. During the decade, traditional masculinity was increasingly deemed to be in crisis as the new man, a figure representing a softer masculinity, rose to prominence in popular discourse, along with other varied, less progressive forms such as the new lad. Along with other organisations and institutions, the FPA held the belief that traditional masculinity was limiting for men, as it produced repressed forms of selfhood, particularly in the way that men's conditioning inhibited emotional expression. Fundamentally, the FPA believed that this impinged on men's ability to build fulfilling intimate relationships that in turn impeded men reaching self-fulfillment, which could only be achieved by living authentically and expressing and communicating one's emotions. The FPA's emphasis on widening emotional expression reflected what Lisa Delap identifies as a wider desire for more expressive intimacies in the late 20th century. Like Delap, this paper and my broader research contributes to the growing body of work seeking to historicise emotion in the late 20th century in Britain. In relation to the theme of this seminar series on emotions and health, then, Men Too provides an insight into how educational campaigns, particularly those focused on emotive issues such as family planning, understood and attempted to manipulate their emotions of their publics amidst this shift, and how the solutions offered by the FPA reflected the broader consideration of emotion from the 1970s onwards. Men's capability to share in contraceptive responsibility was limited by their inability to communicate effectively with their partners, which the FPA deemed to be causing widespread relationship problems, which led to increasingly high rates of divorce. With Men Too, the FPA reimagined the male role in contraception, which ultimately required a reimagining of masculinity along with it. Despite being reluctant to admit that what they were doing was, inadvertently they were doing, was suggesting a new model man, the FPA were part of the broader process through which established masculine norms were increasingly questioned and new masculinities were created and called into being. A new version of the male sexual subject was imagined across various sites and campaigns, an idealised type that was more responsible and emotionally expressive. Men Too was exceptional in that it represented the first mainstream and reimagining on this scale, beyond what anti-sexist men groups had pioneered in the 1970s. The campaign is also located amongst the proliferated debates about sexual politics in the decade, reflecting the growing interest in sexual politics in the mainstream from the 1970s onwards. So in exploring the trajectories that fueled this interest in male involvement in contraception and made Men Too possible, this paper will in turn demonstrate what the campaign and others like it can reveal about masculinity and contraceptive politics in the mid-1980s. And in doing so, this paper is divided into three parts. So the first will explore the campaign within the FPA's shifting priorities. The second situates it in the broader reimagining of masculinity in the 80s. And finally, the third section will examine the impact of the rise and fall in popularity of the pill. So I'll now briefly explain the changing role of the FPA in the 1980s to help us to understand the internal processes that gave rise to Men Too. So the campaign is exemplary of a wider transformation and a shift in priorities at the FPA in the 80s. By then, the organisation had 1,000 of its clinics incorporated into the NHS with the NHS Reorganisation Act. The Act signifies what the long fight for universal free access to contraception had finally been won, in Audrey Leithard's words. The FPA's charitable status prevented further explicit lobbying, and from this point onwards, its function remained primarily discursive, shifting its focus to providing advice and producing educational materials. So the FPA began channeling its efforts into expanding its information and education service and tackling the urgent task of reducing unplanned pregnancies, which apparently universal access to contraception granted by the recent legislation had failed to solve. This concern intersected with more recent fears over the long-term risks of the pill, which included thrombotic complications and most recently cancer. These concerns were then reframed by acknowledgement of the problems or life crises born specifically out of the contemporary climate of the 1980s, which the FPA believed were having a disproportionately negative effect on men who were struggling to cope with their daily lives. Ultimately, these crises amounted to a problem with hegemonic masculinity, which had roots in the post-war period. This focus on men also exemplified a shift away from concerns surrounding population growth in the 1960s and 70s that motivated the 1967 NHS or Family Planning Act, towards prioritising the needs and desires of the individual sexual subject to facilitate his or her personal fulfilment, along with ensuring the well-being of the family, which is exemplified in the FPA's reference to the role of men as husbands and fathers. The involvement of certain key individuals also advanced the FPA's new agenda. Charting the career of family planning advocate Alistair Service helps to trace threads between these similar organisations, which saw him landing pivotal roles at both the Abortion Law Reform Association, or ALRA, and the FPA. In the 60s, Service joined ALRA, joined the ALRA committee, as a parliamentary officer, where he launched an intensive campaign in 1966-67 for abortion law reform, and later introduced the campaign A Woman's Right to Choose in 1979. Whilst at ALRA, in 1970, Service was appointed to the executive board of the FPA. And during his time as chair at the BCC, which is the birth control campaign, between 1970 and 1974, he became known for successfully lobbying to legalise voluntary vasectomy, as well as to ensure free contraception was available on the NHS, irrespective of marital status or age. So with the appointment of Service as the FPA's next General Secretary in 1974, there is a notable shift in vision. When his predecessor Caspar Brooke resigned, he questioned the organisation's doctor-dominated legacy inherited by NHS clinics, stating that he felt the family planning service should have been set in a wider educational and community setting. So Mentu is also an example of this shift taking place. Service's desire to encourage more men to take greater responsibility for contraception, as well as to meet the needs of those who already wish to be involved in contraception, is clearly demonstrated through his lobbying for the legalisation of vasectomy. Service's influence provides a better understanding of the various trajectories within the FPA itself that led to the development of Mentu during his career at the organisation. So now I'll move on to show how the campaign was situated within wider debates surrounding masculinity in the 1980s and how these debates were mapped onto more general narratives of crisis in the decade. So changing male contraceptive behaviour then required an overhaul in attitudes towards what was constituted, towards what constituted the masculine role. The FPA declared a complex sweep of social changes that had unfolded since the post-war had the effect on reducing men's ability to cope with the stresses and strains of modern life. Crisis is a narrative framework often deployed to make sense of the history of sexual politics in the 1980s, used commonly in the context of HIV/AIDS. Although it's often overused, crisis can provide a useful lens for this case study. Margaret Thatcher's government proposed health service cuts in 1983, which threatened family planning services, leading to a reduction in services in some areas. Although little reference is made to government cuts in FPA correspondence, this crisis inevitably forced the FPA to defend its services. As part of Mentu, the FPA proposed the government allocate funding for a targeted national motivational campaign. However, this alone does not account for the campaign's emphasis on men. The FPA articulated a crisis of masculinity, as well as a crisis of contraceptive responsibility in the 1980s, and blamed the pressures to conform to redundant codes of manliness for men's lack of responsibility in intimate relationships with women. The FPA's educational film, Danny's Big Night, tapped into this contemporary debate around masculinity. A sense of masculinity in crisis framed the context for protagonist Danny, but in this video and within the wider campaign, it was reworked as an opportunity for men to change. So, quote, produced specifically with a young male audience in mind, unquote, to trigger discussion around the Men Too theme, the 25-minute film explored issues around what it felt like to be a young man in the 1980s, with a specific focus on this in the context of peer and intimate relationships. The film was set in a multiracial inner city area, assumed to be London's East End in an article in journal Medical News, due to perhaps the use of the East London Youth Theatre Group for its production, which was supported by the London Borough of Newham. So the story centred on the relationship of young couple Danny and his girlfriend Lorraine. The film was a newsreel production produced by Paul Morrison and directed by John White, both of whom had previously been involved in programmes about men for Channel 4. So the film raised important questions about the norms of masculinity through an immediate focus on male body image. The first scene showed Danny trying on jumpers while out shopping with Lorraine, and I'll just show you a quick clip from... Ooh.
think it's gone to sleep. I can show it you on the board anyway. You can click for a minute. Trying to synchronise it.
Ready? Where is it supposed to be? Is it 0:50? Yeah. Is that perfect?
Yeah.
Great.
Oh, hang on. I'll leave it on one. Sorry about this. Precision. Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so close. Can you get to 49?
Oh, for God's sake. 48, I can do.
It might be just... Okay. Yeah, I might be right.
Let's play.
Oh no, neither. Ah, that's what I call nice.
I hope it's all right. Oh, just having a look.
Is that how I try this?
Yeah, sure, you can slip it on here. Check. Oh, you missed your hair up.
Alright. Alright. What do you reckon then?
Yeah. I don't know, I like the red though.
Oh no, I look like Puffin there.
No, you won't. Red will suit you because you're dark.
Okay. The red one is our best-selling one. A lot of men have bought that one.
Yeah, well, I don't want to buy what everyone else buys, you know. What other colours you got?
We've got the yellow and the black.
Yeah. Try the red, Danny. Oh, that looks really good.
Is it worth a try the black one? Black?
So, as you saw in the clip, when Lorraine suggests he buy the red jumper, Danny exclaims that he will look like a puff in that. This moment reflected the narrow boundaries of heterosexual masculinity that restricted male self-experimentation generally by positioning the homosexual male as a site of heterosexual self-definition. So Danny's Big Night was accompanied by an educational resource book, which was designed for group leaders to use with small groups of young people, produced by the FPA's education unit. The resource further illustrates what the FPA were aiming to encourage was a reassessment of masculinity, which was situated in a broader reworking of masculinity in the 80s. Possible questions designed at promoting discussion around masculine norms included, do you ever feel pressured into doing things so as to be seen as normal, before asking, well, what is normal for a man? The various scenes also highlighted Danny's struggle to open up both to Lorraine and to his friends, which was symbolic of men's poor emotional literacy. The FPA's concern around this issue is couched in discussion prompt, do you sometimes find it difficult to talk about problems and end up talking about something else? In reference to Danny's initial reluctance to confide in his friends about an argument he and Lorraine had, initially pretending it was a hypothetical situation. Similarly, in the final scene, which sees Danny calling up Lorraine to apologise for the argument, he initially disguises his embarrassment with humour by pranking her when she answers the phone. Here, the FPA highlighted a problem with masculinity that forced men to repress one of their human qualities the FPA sought to encourage men to practice, which was openness. Men too then must be situated in this wider debate around a reworking of masculinity as the FPA sought to civilise it by encouraging a softer version, urging men to be masculine, not macho. The organisation's idealised male contraceptor shared many common qualities with the 1980s new man, as I've already stated, which was similar to a new version of manhood envisioned by the anti-sexist men's movement in the 1970s. He also represented one strand of the idealisation of a softer, more domesticated version of masculinity that had roots in the post-war period. However, echoing what many books written on masculinity stressed at the time, in order for men to change, the FPA were aware men needed to be provided with a desirable incentive to do so. The organisation reframed crisis as an opportunity for men to change for the greater good of society and for the family, but also for their own personal benefit by emphasising the guaranteed payoff for men's sense of self. Menti emphasised the importance of emotional disclosure for successful intimate relationships. Open discussion around contraception also needed to be vitally encouraged if unplanned pregnancies were to be reduced, particularly amongst teenagers. The FPA understood men's role to be pivotal in reducing the number of unplanned pregnancies, and Menti sought to balance the attention previously given to facilitating women's contraceptive role. However, the FPA knew that it was not enough just to inform and educate men on their new role. Further incentive was needed to incite change through a reimagining of masculinity, which permitted men a broader emotional repertoire to facilitate increased emotional openness. So persuading men of the individual payoff of communicating openly with their partners, being more emotionally expressive, and generally demonstrating care and compassion in intimate encounters became increasingly urgent amidst these contemporary crises. So crisis then was both an opportunity and an imperative for organisations like the FPA to step up their campaigns. Here I'll demonstrate how the FPA engaged with the emotions of its subjects in the campaign. As stated, to mitigate the apparent crises of both masculinity and contraceptive politics, the FPA sought to reimagine masculinity. For this reimagining, it utilised what I define as the politics of self-fulfilment, which is a bit of a hammy phrase, but... Self-fulfillment was a buzzword used by the FPA throughout MEN2, along with shared responsibility and joint decision-making, the cornerstones of effective contraceptive practice, it believed. The FPA believed that emotional authenticity offered the key to reaching personal fulfillment and encouraged men to exhibit warmth, tenderness, sensitivity and openness in their relationships. And quote, the stress was on developing qualities that men are often encouraged to suppress, end quote, so it stated. Traditional masculinity then, which encouraged men to suppress emotions and set narrow boundaries of self-exploration, precluded the process of men's personal fulfilment. The FPA's critique of masculinity has much in common with men's groups and anti-sexist men's periodicals such as Achilles' Heel and its collective of progressive men that made up the British men's movement. The movement also stressed men's estrangement from their emotional selves and sought to incite emotional change as one of its key aims. So, the preoccupation with the idea of a repressed sense of masculine sense of selfhood and the desire for self-fulfillment was in line with what Deborah Cohen defines as a high tide of psychoanalytic influence in 1970s and 1980s Britain. Indeed, the FPA were aware that men's emotional issues were largely the fault of their gendered conditioning from birth. Yet it was increasingly felt that a person could only live authentically if they were open and emotionally expressive. As a sign of emotional authenticity, openness pervaded social relationships from the 1970s onwards and was increasingly held as a precondition for successful intimate relationships, marking a shift in British emotional culture from the post-war period. MEN2 is also situated within this shift, as the FPA also imagined new emotional intimacies. However, despite the normalisation of emotional expression, the MEN2 campaign indicates that by the mid-1980s, emotional expression still required encouragement, particularly amongst men lacking in emotional literacy and through continued adherence to masculine norms. In the campaign, the FPA referred to the process of men finding their true identity released from the shackles of masculinity as guaranteeing this self-fulfillment, as well as more harmonious relationships. Danny Spignight and the various responses it received highlight the premium placed on authenticity at this time. Quote, it's real people looking at real problems and expressing real feelings. To get that degree of reality on an educational video is extremely important, urged Agony Aunt Claire Rayner in her review of the film. The blurb contained on the promotional leaflet echoed her sentiments, describing the film as containing, quote, authentic dialogue and considerable realism. Other viewers stated that the language used in the film added to its authenticity, although some deplored the bad language. Self-fulfillment then could only be achieved through authenticity, honesty and openness. Idealising these human qualities men were conditioned to suppress became increasingly urgent amidst concerned over the reported side effects of the pill. However, in the initial MEN2 press release, the FPA recognised that guilt and discomfort were poor motivators, stressing that the positive benefits to men and women will be stressed on all occasions. The politics of self-fulfillment required approaching a range of political spaces. MEN2 officially began with a press launch on the 2nd of October 1984, setting the agenda for the entire campaign. From then on, an enormous amount of interest was shown in the project from the start by journalists, and the press snapped up developments as quickly as they could be produced. Obviously, that's an FPA quote. The FPA had a clear and ambitious media strategy and sought wide range nationally and locally, relying heavily upon press coverage to generate awareness of issues and promote discussion at all levels. Promoting debate, then, would have been the first step in inciting change within masculinity and contraceptive politics. During 1984-5, the campaign also featured on 72 radio and television broadcasts, including public service announcements on various channels that transmitted information on men and contraception directly into people's living rooms. So this strategic dissemination of discourse on gender and sexuality demonstrates a new expanded nature of politics in terms of the way it was conducted. The use of everyday media forms demonstrates the everyday nature of sexual politics by the ease at which this politics moves fluidly across boundaries between different media, from the beer mats to newspaper reports to educational videos. In other words, the politics of Men Too then was both everyday in terms of its politicisation of the personal, but also in how the FPA similarly governed bodies and emotions by conducting its politics via these everyday media forms. So Men Too also represented the logical next step in the FPA's campaign. I will now demonstrate how the FPA sought to negotiate contraceptive politics with Men Too. As the 1980s approached, Britain's post-pill paradise was turning out to be increasingly short-lived. In 1983, the organisation launched its Pills in Perspective campaign, which sought to mitigate mounting concern around the iatrogenic effects of the pill. The campaign responded to sensationalist media reporting following a study published in medical journal The Lancet, which associated long-term oral contraceptive use with an increased risk of developing breast and cervical cancer in some users, which compounded existing anxieties about the pill and its thrombotic complications. Danny Spignight tackled these issues, particularly in relation to the implications for younger pill users. Although questions in the resource book that accompanied the film do not explicitly explore health-related concerns, they are implicit in Lorraine's decision to come off the pill. During the pivotal scene after Danny and Lorraine returned from returned home after his night after their night out at Benedict's disco with Danny's friends, Danny is shocked to find a packet of Durex condoms in Lorraine's bag whilst he's looking for cigarettes. So I'll just show you a quick clip of this now if it's going to work. Get ready. It should be 12:43. But... oh yeah, got it. I'm on 12:44, so that's fine. There you go. Great. Ready?
1, 2, 3.
Yeah, you got it, folks.
Yeah, not bad.
Have you seen anyone else?
No, of course I'm not.
You sure?
Yes, of course I'm sure.
So what you got them in your bag for?
What?
Durex, Lorraine, Durex.
I didn't expect you to find them.
Oh, who did you expect to find them?
I don't usually keep them in my bag.
Oh, no, where do you usually keep them?
Didn't mean it to sound like that.
Sound like what?
Like I'm some sort of slag or something.
You said it, not me.
Yeah, it's what you were thinking, though, isn't it?
What do you expect me to think?
Not that.
Well, come on, I'm waiting. What you got them in your bag for?
Look, Danny, I told you I was coming off the pill. I don't want to get pregnant.
You are seeing someone, aren't you?
No, I'm not. Look, what's the difference? If you found a packet of pills, you wouldn't say anything, would you?
But that's different.
What's different?
Girls don't carry those sort of things in their bags. Not unless they're fucking...
Slags.
Yes. Oh, but you know I didn't mean you were.
Yes, you did. You want to know why I carry them in my bag? You want to know why I carry them in my bag?
Yes!
Why do you think I carry them, Danny?
All right, let's just forget about it.
Yeah. Let's just forget it. I'm going home.
I'll drive you.
No, it's all right, I'll walk.
I'll drive you.
I said I'll walk.
I'll phone you tomorrow.
So, as we saw in the clip, Lorraine reminds Danny that she had previously told him that she was coming off the pill, so she bought condoms for them to use as she did not want to get pregnant. Lorraine's decision to come off the pill implies that she has done so for health-related reasons, alluding to an awareness of the pill's side effects, rather than the fact that she no longer needs contraception, as her choice to buy a condom signifies, along with her and Danny's plans to go all the way, which was a phrase used in a conversation Danny had with his friends earlier in the clip, in the video, sorry. Indeed, the narrative alludes to the purpose of going to Danny's house was to have intercourse whilst his parents were away. Lorraine represented the thousands of women giving up the pill over its side effects. In 1980, a staggering 80% of young women under the age of 25 were reported to be taking the pill. The scale of the problem meant that the FPA urgently needed to address this demographic, amplified by the fact that this group were considered most at risk of developing breast and cervical cancer later in life. To reiterate, the impact of side effects made it increasingly urgent for organisations like the FPA. I'll just put this back on the board. To provide men with a desirable incentive to reflect on and improve their conduct in intimate relationships, which included increasing their contraceptive involvement. However, the FPA understood that men see little incentive to intervene in an area of expertise which women seem to have under control. In an initial report, FPA research officer Kay Wellings stressed that despite being largely excluded from the clinic movement, that generally men had always been involved in contraception. And only during the 1960s, when the pill gradually supplanted male-directed methods, did the balance of control shift gradually towards women. Yet, assuming greater responsibility was clearly double-edged for women. By the early 1970s, with the growing publicity around the pill's iatrogenic effects, many women were disenchanted with the contraceptive and frustrated with the responsibility it placed on them. This was coupled with the feminist critique of the pill, which suggested that its advent meant that women no longer had an excuse to avoid penetrative sex. The contraceptive was increasingly associated with the opposite of the panacea that it was once regarded, posing a potential health risk to thousands of women, whilst also effectively trapping women into intercourse. Neither did it appear to present the straightforward solution to unplanned pregnancy in the way that its pioneers had once hoped. The problem was exacerbated further by women who were deciding to discontinue use due to side effects, adding to the number of women then at risk of unplanned pregnancy, figures which already stood at 200,000 per year. As the FPA stated, the importance of such effects is highlighted at a time when worrying reports about certain female methods of contraception are causing some women to stop using them. To avoid an increase in unintended pregnancies and further harm to individuals and families, alternative methods of birth control need to be examined. However, women who pursued alternatives risk warranting a promiscuous reputation. As you saw in the clip, during their argument over the condoms, Danny accuses Lorraine of seeing someone else, claiming that girls who carry condoms are slags, implying that Lorraine is one too. In response, Lorraine exclaims, "What's the difference? If you found a packet of pills, you wouldn't see anything, would you?" Here she is highlighting the sexual double standard. And she then leaves Danny's house without resolving the argument, as you saw. So the following day, Lorraine and her friends discuss the connotations of women carrying condoms. The discussion notes reiterate this, including an important question about the gendered nature of different contraceptive methods. And the booklet states, or asks, "What do you think about women carrying condoms? Is it any different from carrying the pill?" Although reports of the pill's side effects were causing some women like Lorraine to turn to alternative methods of contraception, such as the condom, just as many were foregoing protection altogether, particularly younger women who were less likely to be aware of alternative methods or too embarrassed or scared to find out. Indeed, as Danny's Big Night illustrated, stigma accompanied young women who carried condoms, which likely deterred women from obtaining them. The impact of this stigma then added urgency to addressing the issue of contraceptive responsibility, especially amongst young people with whom these issues were particularly prominent. So the shift in contraceptive responsibility, which saw women assuming greater responsibility with the advent of the pill in the 1960s, also reduced the societal expectation on men to be involved in contraception in the years preceding men too. As the original Health Education Council Pregnant Man poster implied in 1970, and Men Too reiterated explicitly in the mid-1980s. So there's the poster there for you. Probably you've seen all that already. So young men were less familiar with condoms, and many simply expected young women to be on the pill due to this widespread use and its increasing uptake among teenage women. As the Pregnant Man poster illustrates, debates around contraceptive responsibility were gaining momentum prior to 1983, but Men Too was designed to raise the profile of this debate, as the pivotal scene in Danny's Big Night demonstrated. Another question in the resource book asked, in a relationship, who is responsible for contraception? which intended to problematise the unspoken roles of men and women, touching on the key issue the FPA strove to explore in depth via the campaign, contraceptive responsibility. The issue of contraceptive responsibility, then, as highlighted by organisations like the FPA, primarily concerned young people. Amongst the older demographic were married men who had completed their families. The increase in voluntary vasectomy since its legalisation in 1972 suggests that encouraging shared decision-making and greater responsibility amongst mature men was less of an issue for the FPA. The FPA acknowledged that mature men wanted to increase their contraceptive involvement, and the campaign was, in part, designed to support the growing numbers of these men who were concerned for the health of their partners taking the pill. However, the FPA ensured the campaign was accessible to them, but greater emphasis was placed on targeting younger adult men like Danny, who ultimately cared for their partners but were somewhat ignorant and ambivalent in regards to contraception and intimate relationships, needing further encouragement to act as efficient contraceptives and supporting partners. Indeed, one of the specific objectives of Danny's Big Night was, quote, to develop ways of increasing boys' self-awareness and self-confidence in their relationships, end quote. A focus that becomes abundantly clear through close examination of the film and the beer mats that I showed you earlier. Further indication that the FPA were imagining a younger adult audience is provided through the film focusing on a young couple. Danny is cast as 17 years old, and during a scene in the film where Lorraine is introduced to Danny's friends, we discover that she is still also a college student, so must be of a similar age as Danny. So the age of the imagined audience is communicated explicitly via FPA correspondence. Yet, in the film, like in the beer mats, these signify the organisation's target demographic, but they also state or imply that this was both classed and racialised in more implicit ways, as this alludes to strikingly in the promotional poster, which I'll just show you now. In a report for Medical News on the 11th of April 1985, director John White was quoted saying that Danny's Big Night broadly represents the working class. As we have seen, this demographic is represented more subtly in the film through the setting, with the film opening with a panorama of the urban environment, which you saw earlier. Moreover, the casting of Lewis Charalambous, who had Greek heritage, suggested that the audience being imagined by the FPA were young men who lived in the inner city, who maybe had migrant families. Characters then were another way that the working class urban demographic was represented, indicated instantly by their East End Cockney accents. In numerous scenes, Danny is depicted working in a garage as a car mechanic, a common occupation of young working class men of Danny's age. Manual labour thus acted as both a signifier of his class status, but also of his masculinity. Considering White's statement, it is likely that this was a deliberate choice in an attempt to mimic reality, as it was an educational resource to help promote authenticity and not to alienate young, ordinary men, the FPA envisioned as the audience of men too. It was vital that young, ordinary, working-class men could relate to the characters and feel like their lives were represented on screen, and that men too were speaking directly to them. Given the content and imagery in Danny's Big Night then, the decision for Boateng, who was mixed race and a member of the GLC, to chair the Men's Sex and Relationships Conference was also a deliberate attempt to appeal to this multiracial urban demographic, whilst the beer mat cemented the campaign's focus on young working class men further still. And I'll just show you some more images that were taken on set of the film. That one on the far right is my particular favourite one. So this image, this imagined audience, indicates that the FPA assumed the younger working class male Briton and his female partner were most in need of extra encouragement to make joint decisions regarding contraception and to practice shared responsibility. By linking this crisis to one of the inner city, represented by characters who are visibly working class and black and minority ethnic in Danny's Big Night, but also through the beer nats and wider campaign they form part of, secures a new sign of sexual politics in the 1980s, one that's rather distant from the realm occupied by Men Meacham's liberal sexual subject, who was likely to be middle class and well educated. In turn, Men Too demonstrates how the FPA were attempting to govern forms of sexual behaviour that were encouraged by the pub environment or Bentley's disco as featured in the film, which they're pictured in there, that were perhaps even potentially transgressive, behaviour that was more widely facilitated by living within the city and moving within the spaces such as the pub or Bentley's disco. The broader campaign then was an attempt to control unruly bodies as much as it permitted men the freedom to be more emotionally expressive and develop more authentic versions of themselves. Clearly, amongst family planners, young working class men were most urgently in need of persuading to take more responsibility for contraception, which first required a reworking and expansion of their concept of what it meant to be a man. So, to conclude, the FPA's Men Too campaign and similar projects represented the changing nature of politics in general in late 20th century Britain, as the intimate and the everyday became increasingly politicised and governed in subtle yet powerful ways. In suggesting new forms for masculine behaviour and envisaging new kinds of emotional intimacies through encouraging emotional expression, the campaign promoted a new form of liberal responsibility through varied everyday media forms in its attempt to manipulate emotions and control bodily practices. So the campaign resonates beyond an exploration of masculinity and contraceptive politics. Rather, as a report in The Lancet in October 1985 argued, quote, at the press launch of the video of Danny's Big Night, correspondents from specialist and national press demonstrated vividly how these triggers used in the film can provoke discussion of our society's sexual stereotypes and mores. In short, the campaign offers a perspective on the broader questioning of the sexual landscape navigated by young working class men in the 1980s and the trajectories that brought this into being. It also provides evidence of the subsequent reimagining of masculinity to permit increased emotional expression, which would ultimately guarantee personal fulfilment and a reworking of contraceptive politics by promoting male involvement and shared responsibility in contraception. This reimagining was urgently required to mitigate the crises of both masculinity and contraceptive responsibility in the 1980s, and is part of a broader reimagining of masculinity in the late 20th century. As Frank Moore has argued, this period saw men's changing role debated in a wide variety of settings. Men Too is evidence that this debate permeated discussions of family planning and men's intimate sexual relationships, which is indicative of the breadth of this reworking. The campaign raised urgent questions about what it meant to be a young working class man, especially one living in one of Britain's urban centres. With a specific focus on his role in intimate relationships, including contraception, campaigns like Men Too idealised the responsible, caring and emotionally expressive male sexual subject and brought him into being. Thank you for listening. And I leave you with some quite interesting, if not disturbing, early logo designs for the campaign. There you go.
I'll send you an uncut recording and then.
All right. So, has anyone got any questions for Katie? Just to kick us off. Virginia.
Just some questions about the context of what was going on in terms of the production. This was FPA, but you also showed The Pregnant Man from the 70s. Mm-hmm. What was the HEC, HEA doing? Was it doing anything like this in parallel, or was this left up to the FPA to?
So the health, the education unit, which was set up in the 70s, was sort of a joint project of the HEC and the FPA. So all the educational materials that the FPA brought out were in conjunction with the HEC. So they were working quite closely together at this point.
Right.
But I am yet to go into the archives at the Welcome, because they've all just been, I suppose most of you know this, but they're all being transported to the Welcome and sorted at the moment. So I'm hopefully going in to have a look at those fairly soon. And that'll hopefully help to add a bit more context to this particular a bit of research I'm doing. So yeah, thank you.
I was in England for part of this in my 20s. And back in the States in the 80s, got very involved with the men's movement and facilitated some workshops at international men's conferences and stuff. And one of the things, I mean, this is slightly off the subject of birth control, but one of the things that has stuck with me is that women were doing a lot of pressuring men then, it's okay to cry, it's okay to cry, show your feelings, it's okay to cry. And every single man in every single group I co-facilitated, said that every time he cried in front of a woman, she broke up with him. She ended the relationship. She wasn't attracted to him anymore. And that's sort of stuck with me, that it wasn't just men in isolation. It was our behavior, which bears some looking at as well with regard to all of this, because our behavior and our expectations of them and their sensitivity kind of needed to change a bit and didn't. They were still under a lot of pressure to be masculine, to be in charge, to be, you know, I mean, in my family growing up, I grew up in a, my father had three girls and my wife, and I mean, my mother, his wife, and that what we used to say in our family was, give daddy the rotten peaches. You know, if something was slimy, if something was disgusting, men don't care what they eat. If something's disgusting to touch, let a man touch it. They don't care. So this whole attitude that if something's stinky, men don't mind. And so all of this with the birth control, all of it has to be, you know, the guys have some, you know, the pressure that was put on them to man up at all times.
Yeah,
it's fascinating.
That's right, and I think as I mentioned in the talk, there was this new, the idea of the new lad was another sort of trope that came out in the 80s as well, which was sort of a more hardened version of the new man, sort of in response to that sort of ideal in a way, or not, because often the new man was also laughed at and it was like a figure of fun as well as like an ideal that the FBA sort of cultivated. So yeah, there's definitely this sort of juxtaposition between like a softer, more emotional version and then this hardened sort of laddie type that was, yeah, so there was a lot of different sort of formulations of masculinity going on.
And still not a lot of talk, open talk about male sexuality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and that the whole interrelationship of men and sex and women and sex and stuff. Because we all were still looking at them as wanting to have sex at any opportunity all the time, 24 hours a day with anything that moved.
Yeah.
And that was still our expectation. And so they were trying to live that. It was fascinating to listen to them. It wasn't so.
Is anyone home? Alex?
Yeah, can I ask a question about kind of impact and its sort of broader, well, the extent to which they felt they had achieved what they set out to do? Because obviously they've got this very broad goal, reconfiguring masculinity. Wow, that's a huge goal. But they've also got, in some ways, got quite a specific goal as well about trying to increase uptake of contraception. Did they attempt to measure their success at all? Or?
Yeah, they did. So I think Kay Wellings actually wrote the report, which is like an evaluation of the project. And they did find that the number of men visiting clinics actually rose in 1985-86, I think it was. They took the they did the report. So it did have some effect. And they sort of called on, I'm looking at this in my sort of broad research at the moment, they sort of called on the NHS and things to make clinics more appealing to men and broaden their service range and sort of, yeah, advertise them as places that men were welcome to go to and access advice as well as supplies, because there's still a contentious issue around whether these certain kind of services could offer condoms, because there's, yeah, various issues going on there. So the idea of making the clinic a space to access advice and information as opposed to just provisions, supplies, was something that they were calling on a lot of organisations to do. And I think they did notice a difference, and they made a lot of sort of inroads in schools and things like that with Danny's Big Night, but I'm not sure exactly how long lasting that impact was, and it's hard to measure, obviously, so yeah.
Just to go back to the video, Danny's Big Night, who saw it? I mean, how did they access the audiences for that?
So it was first showed at the conference that I mentioned. So they had this big conference on men, sex and relationships here in London, where loads of sort of stakeholders were invited to go and members of the public as well. It was first shown there. And then after that, it was made into a tape and then sent around to various schools, and you could, various like youth organisations could opt into the programme, and they were sent an educational resource book as well that was used with small groups of people, young people. Which had various sort of questions in it that and discussion prompts that were asked to the groups after they'd seen the film, and sort of it was supposed to sort of promote discussion around these issues like masculinity and contraceptive responsibility mainly. But there's also other things that go on in the film which I didn't have time to show you, which kind of draw more broadly on men's relationships with other men and things like that.
Because the problem has been, I mean, you can access pupils in schools and then maybe in technical colleges, as there were further education colleges or youth groups perhaps, but the general problem of accessing the post 16 year old is one that before the age of YouTube and so on, it was a difficult thing to do. So I suppose then they would realise that there were large numbers of young people who wouldn't have. So then the Beer Mats was an attempt to get to a sort of wider audience, was it?
That's right, yeah. And they also did various public service announcements as well, which would go on sort of prime time when they hoped sort of young people would be with their families watching TV at home and things like that. But again, I don't know exactly how much of an impact that would have had. But yeah, the Beer Mats were supposed to just be displayed. Well, they were displayed in over 6,000 pubs, so you'd hope they'd reach some people, although my dad hasn't seen them, and a lot of, he's asked some people and they haven't seen them either, so, or they don't remember them anyway. So yeah, I'm still unsure as to how far it kind of, the message got.
Did they use soaps? I mean, that was the other thing, the idea of trying to get soaps to take up an issue. Did they do that at that
Not
time?
To my knowledge. They were they produced another film which was for younger boys called Boys 2, but I can't get access to that anywhere. I don't know where that's gone. like most things, if you're a historian. But yeah, I think they wanted to develop more programmes with the directors that made Danny's Big Night to have them shown on TV, but I don't know how far that actually got because the paper trail sort of fades out there. So I'm not entirely sure, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it was a while before Grange Hill did an unplanned pregnancy plot.
Yeah. I thought it was very interesting, and also I didn't know that how much stigmatism attached to the condom, because it's quite different from what I, like from my country, for example, in Japan, condom is more common, and then pill is, people are stigmatized to the promiscuity, and it hasn't been introduced as a contraception in the late 90s. So it's quite interesting. My question was, I want to know the background, for example, about the male involvement in like pregnancy and childbirth. Is it like around the same time, or is it there some influence from like more involvement in childbirth to on this contraception?
Thank you. So this is not really my field, but I know Laura King, who's a historian of sort of masculinity as well, she works on this, I think she states that men being present at childbirth is a sort of a phenomenon that starts happening sort of after the Second World War in Britain. So I think I mentioned in the paper that this idealisation of sort of a softer version, more involved version of masculinity in terms of personal relationships and things like that sort of was occurring much earlier on than the 80s. But the FPA was sort of the first big organisation to draw upon this change and like, make a big impact of it, basically, and try and draw more men to become more involved partners, I suppose. Yeah.
I'm going to take Chair's prerogative and ask a question. I was just wondering, Danny's Big Night Out is delivered with a workbook.
Mm-hmm.
How sort of structured are the kind of the discussions and the questions, and what can you tell about how they're imagining that kind of classroom situation, be it at school or in a youth group or whatever, look like? Was it a mixed discussion group, or was this a discussion about masculinity being had by boys, or were girls or women expected to be having these discussions about masculinity with boys or on their own?
I think it was generally designed to be mixed, but also kind of with a focus on boys, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the discussion prompts are really structured. I think I was reading a few of them out. They're really defined and like don't leave much room for the discussion leader to actually sort of ask his own questions. So I suppose that that's the point, that discussion prompts, and then whatever comes out of the discussion will form, you know, another question or whatever. But you can go and view them in the Welcome if you're really interested, and they're really great. Actually, you can actually access the whole resource book with all the questions in. And there's a lot actually on homosexuality in there as well, which I was surprised to see, because in the rest of the correspondence and literature on the campaign, it mentions it very little, which is interesting.
Thanks. Have we got any final questions before we wrap up? Right, well, in that case, I'd like everyone to join me in thanking Katie once again for a brilliant paper. So next week, we've got Lara Marks giving her paper on hepatitis. Do please join us. It will be the final paper in this portion of the seminar series, which will relaunch again next semester, again around the theme of health and emotion.